This is an Alien UFO Podcast extra episode, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. In this extra episode, I'm talking to Steve Neal about his ET experiences, how real-to-life UFO movies are, and the similarities between the alien abduction experience and near-death experiences. Steve is a special effects makeup artist, filmmaker, puppeteer, model maker, and visual effects artist in the film and television industry with a career spanning over 35 years. Steve worked on Star Trek, The Motion Picture. His first assignment was to make Spock's ears. He also worked on Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, as a sculptor and prosthetic maker of numerous Klingon foreheads. Additionally, he worked on Star Trek The Next Generation pilot episode, Encounter at Farpoint. He also worked on Ghostbusters, Fright Night, and many other sci-fi and horror films. His book, But Something Is There, details his many ET experiences. We start off having a little conversation about my book, which Steve has just read. Well, hi, Steve. Thanks a lot for coming back on the podcast. It's great to talk to you again.
You too, Simon. Really been enjoying your book.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's a lot of hard work, but it's worth it in the end, isn't it? You know what it's like.
Because that book has a lot to say. You know, I know for the materialists, the scientists, it's not proof to them because they have to be able to measure something and hold it in their hands. And I understand why they behave the way they do. But with this book, just like with the telepathy tapes, I mean, it's hard to discount someone who's had that experience and the people that are doing the operation or in that situation with paramedics or whatever it may be, know that they're flatlined, know that they're dead. And yet when they come out of it, in some cases to their horror, they're able to tell them everything that happened and they know there's no way. It completely spooks them out. And that should mean something, but to the materialists, no, it doesn't. It's just amazing to me how they discount it. Not all of them.
Yeah, not all of them. But do you see anything in UFOs and ET encounters that comparable, that there's some kind of verification of it? Because there just doesn't seem to be. It's like the visitors can do what they want and get away with it. There's never any real proof, is there?
No. Well, we've had implants that are hard to disprove. They do it all the time. The classic thing is, well, you fell down and, you know, on your knee and a piece of meteoric material got in your knee and your body grew around it and that's all it is. But there should be a scar. And then the analysis of the implants, because I was very close to Roger Lear and I was present at many of the surgeries with Whitley and many other people. And the analysis that we've done on those things, they were clearly not material made on Earth. And they had properties like radio waves and nanotubes inside of them that we just couldn't explain.
There was some real solid scientific examination of these implants, wasn't there? It wasn't just somebody had a quick look under a microscope.
No, there was, but it was still discounted. And I really think a lot of that has to, not all scientists felt that way, but the scientists that did believe in it, if they were to go public with, hey, this is real, you know, this implant to me is not something I can explain, then the materialists, the Tyson types, they all throw rocks at them and they destroy their careers. And so there's that problem is being brave enough. I mean, that's what amazes me about Gary Nolan is he doesn't care. He just looks at the camera and says it like it is. And I'm sure they talk about him behind his back, just like they did Dr. Mack and the rest of them. But, you know, in the same way with near-death experiences, there are so many people, there are so many cases, and they don't know each other, and they're unrelated, and many of them go back before the internet. It's difficult to explain how people who don't know each other, have never studied the subject matters, not just UFOs, have universally the same tale to tell. And what's even more interesting about it is reading your book and listening to telepathy tapes, is realizing the connection, because this really gets down to consciousness. And the simple fact, and I believe it is a fact, that our consciousness is not our brain. Our brain is just an organ. You know, it's like it was said in your book. It's like the brain is a receiver of consciousness, but it's not the consciousness. And I believe that's true. I don't know how else you would explain away all these people. And this is, your book's the tip of the iceberg. There are millions of cases out there of this. And people that have had experiences with non-human intelligence. And the interesting thing to me about non-human intelligence encounters and near-death experiences and telepathy tapes is that they're all related too, because whoever these visitors are, they behave a lot like the spirits, the beings, the spirit guides. Some people think it's God. Some people think it's angels. When they have these experiences, they all behave very much in the same manner. And there are so many things that are identical. Like I was talking to you earlier about before we started recording. I'm doing a show right now about this man in Florida who's he's never thought about this stuff at all. He was the furthest thing away from his mind. He's a hardworking guy. He's having a fight with his girlfriend. He goes out on the porch. He has a beer to try to settle down. And when he's looking in the sky, he sees this bright light appear out of nowhere, but it keeps coming. And then there's more and more spacecraft coming out of it, this big triangle. And it's right in his neighborhood. And he's just exasperated by this thing. And he walks out to get a better look at it, hits him with this beam of light. And what I had heard in your book over and over again from people is that they saw this bright light. It was so bright that any normal set of eyes would have been damaged or you would have been in pain looking at it. But there was no pain. You could look right into it. It didn't hurt at all. He describes, as I'm editing, this exact same thing coming from a craft that appeared in a starry sky like it came out from behind a veil. He described it like there's a black curtain there or something, and it was just poking its way out, slowly but surely, into reality. And then it hits him with the bright light he could look right into without hurting his eyes. And that's just one similarity. It goes on and on and on.
And what was he picked up then? Was that bright light like that, the idea of a tractor beam, that, you know, that classic kind of thing?
Well, he said he was surrounded in it, and that's all he could see after a point. And then it went away, and he watched the craft turn and leave. And as it left, he felt this sadness. He wanted to stay with it. He didn't want to come back here. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
How many people? Every single person in that book so far has said that exact line. And then he looks down at his watch. Well, when this all started, it was like 9 o'clock in the evening. Now it's 3:30. He says, it only seemed like a few minutes. He lost 6 hours, and he's never gone to have hypnosis or anything like that. So he doesn't know what happened during that time. But as time went on, he starts talking about how he started having like these flashes, and he saw this Egyptian face coming at him, and he saw symbols and stuff. So he started drawing him down. The thing you later find out in his conversation is he talks about he had a near-death experience, which really caught my attention, but he doesn't go into detail. But as he's describing his dream or this experience he has, he says, I'm in my car. I'm going down a road I don't know, and it flips over, and I go into blackness, which, you know, I have to ask him about this later, but I think he had a car accident, and that's how he had a near-death experience. And so these two experiences, his near-death experience and what he witnessed in the sky, were related. Clearly, they were related, but I wouldn't have come to that conclusion so quickly without reading your book. It just had fresh in my mind all these people and the parallels to each case. There is only slight deviations. And really, that's based mostly on that person's personal perception of reality, their faith, their religion, and how they see things. But other than that, it was the same. Almost every single story was the same. It was so consistent. And that just amazed me.
And I also see consistencies in the after effects as well, with people who've had NDEs can't wear watches because they won't work, and electronic devices are weird around them, and they have amazing synchronicities. But people who encounter ETs have the same kind of thing happening, don't they? Even some of them talk about like poltergeist activity in their house.
Yeah. And they're more perceptive to telepathy, ESP. They've always had special abilities, but they were locked up. Somehow this opened it up. It released it, and they start to have abilities that they never had before, or at least they think they
have. Do you have psychic abilities at all?
I believe I do. I was talking to my granddaughter when she was here not too long ago, and I was talking about some of these things, and I was talking about not about aliens or near-death experience, but I was talking about the fact that human beings have the ability to have far sight and to be able to see things just by using their mind to see it. And she's, well, give me an example. And I said, well, they have these cards. They're called ESP cards. And they have little wavy lines on them, and X and zero and a star and a cube, you know. I'm listening to all these things. And she listened to everything I said. And she went into the bedroom and got some paper. And she made up a set of cards based on everything I told her. And she came back to the kitchen and said, okay, what am I seeing? And I said, a square. She goes like this, and she looks exasperated. Okay, that was probably coincidence. She puts it down. What am I seeing now? I said, star. Because what I do is I don't think about it at all. I just, when someone does that, when they have they hold the card up like that, it just pops right into my mind. And if I hesitate, then I get it wrong. But if I immediately act on what I'm seeing, I get it right 100% of the time. And I did with her, and she was exasperated. I could tell. She says, how are you doing this? Because she didn't, I don't think, really accept that that I had psychic abilities. But what I tried to tell her is that we all do. We just, when you don't believe something, you turn it off. And we have been indoctrinated by our culture and our teachers and our religions since day one that these things aren't real and they don't exist. And if you think they do, you have serious problems. You're crazy. And so so she tried it, and she got 9 in a row. But then she started 9 out of 10, that she started messing up, because I could see her going like this. And I said, you're done. The minute you do that, you have to tell me what you see first in your mind. The very first thing will be the correct thing, 9 times out of 10. So that was a really interesting experiment. I've had precognitive dreams fairly often. My car was sideswiped one night in a dream, parked on the street. It was a nice little sports car I had, and I had a car cover over it, and it was night. And in the dream, I hear my alarm going off. I go down, and I grab the car cover, and as I'm lifting it up, I see pieces come away from the side of the fender, and they glistened in the streetlight that was over there. And next night, I wake up, my alarm's going off. I go down, and as I'm grabbing the car cover, I went, wait a minute. And I looked up the streetlight, and I looked down, and went like this, and they glistened and dropped to the ground. It was exactly my dream, except the dream came first, and then that came afterwards. So I've had stuff like that a lot. And I believe that given time and some effort and some work, that I can increase these abilities.
Do you think they may have been kind of, I don't know, amplified or like switched on because you were encountering these ETs, and they use telepathy with you, so it's like opening something up.
Maybe. I don't know. But I there is so much in reading these cases in your book and listening to the Children of the Telepathy tapes that is so, not just similar, almost exact to my experiences with the visitors. They say the same things. They show you the same things. I've been to that beautiful place with the incredible colors and all the flowers and everything. And I've been to those places more than once. One thing I didn't know about was reading your book was that so often people describe when they're in the afterlife that they're wearing these white gowns or these white robe type things. And one of the experiences I had was coming to, I'm holding a baby all wrapped up, this little creature, and there's a whole bunch of us doing that. And we're all wearing those white gowns. And I'm looking around, and I mean, I knew I was awake and that I was somewhere else. It wasn't dreamlike at all. I remember there was a retainer wall to the next of us and a sidewalk that we were on, the building right here. It was a narrow corridor, but it was open. You know, you could see the sky and there were trees, dirt coming up the embankment, and the trees were up top. So it was a very natural kind of environment. It's like we're at some building and we're on the side of it. We're all standing in line. We have these babies, and I took my arm out because I really wanted to know if I was awake, that this was really happening. And I remember touching which I thought was concrete and feeling the roughness of it and saying, I'm awake. This is real. And I didn't wake up. You know how when you have a lucid dream, very vivid lucid dream, sometimes you get so excited you wake yourself up. I couldn't do that. I wasn't waking up. And we kept moving forward. And then we got to the end of the line and there was a visitor standing there. And then we were to go into this this room, which is like a, it was like a stadium, a big high ceiling and everything. And there were all these people in there. And that's when it stopped. I don't remember anything after that. But we were wearing those robes and all dressed in white. And that was the only time that happened. So as I'm reading your book, I'm saying to myself, in having these experiences with the visitors, I feel like I have had near-death experiences repeatedly, not just the one I described to you with Judy back in when I was 26 years old. I did talk about that one, I know. And that's the one where she died at her friend's house for a brain aneurysm and came to me in my sleep, pulled me out of my body into the very realm that they describe. What really got me is how they describe the music. That music is amazing. And that's the music I heard in the background. I described it as being sort of an ambient music, New Ages almost, but that wasn't really, it's hard to describe it. There's so many things that happen to us that just can't be described well with the English language or any language. Which brings me back to the brain is very, it limits us a great deal when we're in physical form, and when we're out of our bodies, everything's 360. You connect with everything. I mean, you know what they're thinking, all of that. And it's so much the same as the near-death experiences. That's really got me thinking more than ever.
Yeah, when you were in that queue holding the baby, how many right. people were there? When you went into a stadium, were there thousands?
It got really fuzzy when I got into the stadium that I was told to go in there, and I walked in and I got to look around for a second, but it was really dim. At that point, something was happening. I was fading away from it. When I was standing in line, ahead of me had to be at least 15, 20 people, and I didn't look behind me, but I felt there were people behind me as well.
And did the baby look human?
No. No, not really. It was darker complexion, and the eyes, they had eyes. They weren't black, you know, but it looked odd. It looked very odd.
One of the things I find with near-death experiences is some of the people talk about a location and then somebody else will talk about it. Like, it sounds like they're going to the same location. In the book, I think there's three of them talk about going to this big white building that's like a building of knowledge and learning. And there's three of them who probably don't know each other, didn't, you know, who visited that. But what I wanted to ask is, in your experience with the visitors and all the experiences you've talked to, has there ever been a time where somebody's described what happened and somebody else has said, hang on a second, I've been to that room, or I've been there, I know exactly what you mean?
The white room? Yes. I've heard it many times. And when I was in high school, often during every week, I would be in that. I'd wake up, go to sleep, wake up in that room. I've never been near having a near-death experience. The closest thing was when Judy pulled me out of my body, because she was so excited to show me that I was right about this stuff. It was just, I'll never forget it as long as I live. So, yes, they have talked about it, and Ian Whitley's talked about it, and it's almost like a holding room, a wayward position between here and where you might go next.
In my hypnotic recollection of an experience with the visitors, which I'm not sure it really happened, it turned up during a past life regression, and I think I told you about it, but there was a white room during that experience that had all these seats coming out of the wall like they were...
Yeah, that's described over and over again. I hear that all the time. They're molded in.
Yeah.
But it's almost like white limbo. I mean, you have to look very hard to see if there's any structure going on in there. That's what was my recall of it. And I used to meet with this woman, and there was like this tent thing in the middle of the room, and that's where she was, inside this open sort of white tent. And she was all in white. There was all these pillows at the base on the floor. And we'd go in there and we'd have long talks and intimacy and all kinds of just bizarre stuff. And I remember waking up in the morning to go to school and just saying, God, what the hell was that? You know, I had no idea at that time. So all I thought was I had very vivid dreams.
With bizarre stuff, was there anything that was really bizarre that happened? Real high strangeness?
Well, you kind of get used to it, and so it's kind of hard to, it's all very strange, but then again, it, after years and years and years, I mean, I'm 73 now, I've been going through this since, you know, my earliest memories are 6 years old, and maybe a little bit before. I have some bizarre memories of being in the crib and seeing these faces looking at me, and they weren't human, but it's all very strange. Just doesn't feel so much so anymore to me.
Yeah. And have you had an interaction with visitors recently?
No, it's been a while. The last time was when my crystal disappeared and then reappeared. It clearly was gone, and then it just was there right before my eyes out of nowhere. But it's been, and it'll go like that. I've gone a few years without anything, and then suddenly it'll come back again. You're not even thinking about it, and it just happens. And you wake up the next morning and say, oh my God, you know, it happened again. And you find marks in your body and little bits and pieces of evidence that it actually occurred. I mean, like Mary getting up and I'm not in bed, and her looking all through the house in the back and the other side of the building and looking all through and couldn't find me. And she just went back to bed. Something told her, oh, you'll be back in the morning. And then I was. And then the same thing happened to me. I got up and she was gone. And it really frightened me. I mean, I looked everywhere and couldn't find her. I said, God, I'm just supposed to go back to bed. So when I got out of the bathroom, I went back in and checked for her again, and she was there. But I mean, the first time when I got up and realized she wasn't there, I thought she was in the bathroom. So I went back and checked, and I mean, I literally looked at the covers and moved them back, and she was not there. So I go look for her. I come back and she's there. I finally went to the bathroom. When I came out, I'm just, what am I going to do? And there she is laying in bed.
But it's very worrying. But at the same time, do you feel like I know she's going to be back? She's going to be okay.
Yeah, I did. But she's a lot calmer with all this than I can be in situations like that. She just said, oh, he'll be back in the morning. And I don't know how much of that was suggestion from whatever intelligence was behind that or spirit. But with me, I started thinking, if she didn't, what if she never shows up again? What are people going to think? I'm going to tell them that, oh, she disappeared with aliens. They'll lock me up, you know, and all that went through my mind. And then I go back into the bedroom. There she is. I was just such a relief. So much so, you really didn't even think very long about, my God, man, she disappeared completely. You didn't find her anywhere in the house. How is that even possible? I was just relieved she was back, and then I could go back to bed and not worry about it, you know?
Did she remember anything?
No, she didn't. And I didn't remember anything either when I was missing.
Do you feel like the visitors take your memories away, or they can block your memories? So that if you do remember, it's because they want you to remember. They've let those memories come through.
It might be for that reason, but I don't know that for sure. That's the problem with that is I'm very certain that they block memories. There's things they don't want you to remember. But if you do remember stuff, I'm not sure if that's because they want you to remember or you simply. Their blocking didn't work, wasn't completely successful. It's hard to say. In your book, so many people, the guides, the spirits, the beings would block their memories of things. Very similar. And they talked in the same way. No, you have to go back. No, we don't want you to remember that. That's very much the way the visitors speak. Now, I think the visitors are, well, whatever they are, I think they're very well aware that the astral plane, whatever you want to call it, is very real. And they understand that they're very much part of it. And they understand that their bodies are not who they are. And that has given them a presence of mind being physical that most beings like ourselves would have to work hard to achieve.
Yeah, I think Whitley Strieber talks kind of like that about the fourth mind and what the fourth mind is.
Yeah. But there's no question that, to me, that our intelligence, our ability to connect with everything around us, I mean, the entire universe and every living thing in it is hindered by being in the physical body. But I do believe that there's a way that we can make it so we're not so limited, or maybe not limited at all. Maybe by a simple awareness that we can be physical, be in the physical plane, and still have that ability to connect with everything, communicate with it, to be psychic. And if you get around to listening to telepathy tapes, you'll see how that's possible. Because these children, these kids, they're not all, some of them are grown up now, but their earliest recollections are being purely conscious and being able to telepathically communicate with other kids throughout the world. They go to this place called the Hill, and they meet there. But they're, for the most part, they were all unfamiliar with their bodies initially. They almost didn't realize they had them. They don't feel so connected to their bodies. They have to struggle to work within their bodies, because they exist mostly in pure consciousness. And that's why they're non-speakers, and that's why they're considered vegetables by the materialist academic community. And they don't acknowledge the fact that they can communicate through spelling, and they do it rather well. And no matter how much proof they have, no matter how many tests they run them through, the people that have made up their minds continue to refuse to believe that they're intelligent. Not only are they intelligent, they're vastly intelligent. They're savants. They're geniuses. And it's because They're not limited by their being captured by their brain and body as much as we are. And I think the visitors are really aware of this. I think this is how they are like them. They're non-speakers for the most part. Whenever you deal with the visitors, you never see their mouths move. They never speak, but you hear them. And you interpret it as language when you're talking about it. But if I go back and really think about those communications, it was more like they were transmitting conceptual information to me rather than language. I just knew what they were thinking. I knew what they meant. I didn't need them to say, go to the door. I just knew that's what I had to do. I saw it. That's what they want me to do. Language can't articulate it well at all.
Was there ever anything with the visitors that you've experienced or you've heard of that would hint at reincarnation?
You know, I'm finding it difficult to separate out what I've been reading in your book and hearing on the tapes from them. And I do know of other people that have visitor experiences that are quite amazing. And they talk about, for lack of a better term, the grays and how they grow bodies. And when the body that they're in is coming to the end of its time, they just shift into the next body and they continue on. They do remember who they are. They just, like we change clothes now, or a heavy overcoat. And you know that term because it's in your book. They talk about that. So I have heard that. With my experience dealing with them, we've never talked about reincarnation. It's more how it feels to me is that we both know that that's real. And so what's the point of talking about it? You know that this body's not you, and you know when it dies, you're going to go somewhere else. But the thing I have found so fascinating by reading your book again is that you have a choice. And you can either go down the tunnel and get reborn, and you won't remember initially your past. It's there, but you won't remember it. You remember it mostly when you're a child, and then it'll fade away. And then when you get older, it'll start coming back to you, these feelings of a previous life or previous lives. And then you go through the cycle again. I think a lot of people choose to come back. I don't know that I will. I feel like I've been through this so many times and I need a vacation.
But I feel like there's a human viewpoint and a soulful viewpoint. And when we're down here and we're in these bodies and living this life, we think, oh, I don't want to come back here again. But the soul will look at it and think, this is great. I'm learning so much. I'm definitely coming back again.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully if I do come back, we'll still have sports cars and racing, because it's silly as that sounds. You know, I love aviation. I love model building. I love flying airplanes. I love driving cars. I love doing art. These are all the things that are so wonderful in my family and my friends about life. And that's what we're sent here to learn. And then, of course, take that knowledge and contribute it to the collective data bank, or whatever you want to call it, that universal knowledge that souls have experiences, and then everyone else gets to that, because we're all connected, gets to understand those experiences, understand those emotions, and benefit from it in all kinds of ways, both the good and the bad. And if you're in a body and you're a human being on Earth, you know, people often will say, well, if there's really spirits watching over you and aliens, why don't they heal you if you have cancer? Why don't they, if you lose a leg, why don't they grow it back for you? Because to me, if you come here to experience life and being human on this planet, then you need to experience. And those things are all part of it too. Fighting illness, beating it, fighting illness, and succumbing to it, and you move on. It's all important knowledge, important experience, and it's something that is being shared with all consciousness. That's how I see it.
There's an idea that visitors have lost something over time, and by interacting with humans, they can get it back or get a taste of it. And one of those things is emotion. Have you come across this idea? Do you think this might be happening?
I've heard that, you know, and I don't know. I've talked to a lot of people, and they feel they do have emotions. And a lot of people say, no, they're autonomous, and they're like robots. And I just to be honest, my gut feeling when dealing with them is that they do have emotions, and that they're very aware of, but they like connecting into you. Now, in reading near-death experiences, you see that all over the place. You see everyone saying how they could feel, especially in a life review, they can feel how that person felt when you told them off because you lost your temper one day and it really affected them for a long time. And you see exactly what the results were of that interaction. And you feel bad about it, but you're not judged because, again, that was just part of how life works. And I think the visitors are aware of all of that. But I also think that maybe physically there is something they're missing in their physical form. But what confuses me about that is that certainly they would have the ability to change that without needing us, not unless there's something I'm missing. But for some reason, they seem to be making these hybrids, which are, it's a physical form somewhere between us and them. And maybe it's just something that they want to do. It's just simply, it's something to do. Let's try this. I don't know.
Maybe it's a program that they've been running for hundreds of thousands of years, and they've messed with human evolution, and we're only halfway through that program, and hybrid's just the next step of it.
Yeah, I've always thought that since I saw the movie 2001.
Yeah.
You know, because that baby at the end obviously was the next step in human evolution.
Well, that's a difficult film to interpret in places, isn't it? It is for me, anyway.
Well, you know, I mean, I always saw it very black and white. I mean, I knew that the Australopithecus in the beginning was supposed to be us. Those are our early ancestors. And it was clear to me that they were starving to death and they weren't going to survive. So along comes this alien intelligence, and it changes something in them that allows them to use tools. They learn how to kill, eat meat, but they also use it against each other, which is where things became problematic, I think, for the visitors. And so they went to the moon and they buried another monolith in Tycho, buried it. No sunlight could really reach it, and it couldn't be seen. And they realized, I think, if we were successful enough to get past our violent stage and reach a point where we could actually go to the moon and find that object, that we would dig it up. And once we dug it up and the sun rose, it would send a beacon to them, which also went to Jupiter. And of course, the next step, of course, was Dave and going to Jupiter and seeing the massive monolith that opened up and pulled them through time and space. And again, like the Australopithecus, he went through the next step in evolution, and that was the Star Child coming to Earth. And I remember the last lines in the book, author's book, and said he didn't know what he'd do next, but he'd think of something. You know, after he detonated all the nuclear orbiting platforms in orbit. A lot of people didn't realize that when the bone was tossed up and it spun and then it became a spacecraft, they just thought that was a spacecraft. They didn't realize that was a nuclear orbiting platform, a bomb. They had the Russian star on it, and one of them did, I believe, but those were bombs.
So you've worked in a lot of movies, all sorts of science fiction stuff. But
yeah.
Do you have a view on what is the best UFO movie. So not like science fiction like Star Wars or Star Trek, but I mean like Close Encounters of the Third Kind or another one.
Well, 2001's my favorite because really it's a story about human evolution and how it's been influenced by an alien presence. And it even gets to the hybrid at the end. It was a hybrid human. And it went right under the noses of 90% of the viewing public. They made something much more complex out of it than it was. And it was actually a very simple story of human evolution influenced by a higher intelligence. And so really, that's, and Dave was abducted, quite literally. So that was, and then of course we have AI in it too with Hal. So that was really, for me, one of the best movies ever done on the subject matter. Then Close Encounters came along. And if you know a great deal about the subject matter, then you'd know watching the film that there were a lot more going on there than meets the eye, that Spielberg knew a great deal more than he was letting on to. But he had it. There's all those Easter eggs in that film that were all based on real things that actually happened, including the ending, which... something very similar like that did actually take place back in 1968. And I was told by one of the most famous scientists in the world that happened secretly behind a curtain on a TV show. So that film portrayed Richard Dreyfuss's character was really, really quite accurate. When I was growing up, I saw UFOs all the time and I had weird experiences, but I never thought they were related. I just thought it was really cool and I learned everything I could about it. And then when, of course, communion came along, there was that big light bulb went off. Oh my God, I've been having these experiences. I didn't even realize there was real. All these other people had it and that being on the cover. And I got pretty obsessed with the whole subject matter, so much so that I drove my girlfriend away and a lot of my friends and stuff, because they said, you're too obsessed with UFOs. But at that point in time, after the film, I was really paying attention more and all kinds of stuff was happening to me. And then communion, it turned me upside down. And yeah, I got pretty obsessed. And Richard Dreyfuss's character was a very accurate portrayal of what happens to people that discover this in their lives, or they have an experience. He's just a lineman. He's driving down the road one night and he sees this UFO and it's very much like what I'm editing right now. Steve, is just a regular guy. He's a great guy. I love him, but he's just hardworking guy, never thought about UFOs or any of that kind of stuff. And he, one night he's sitting on the porch and this immense triangle comes out of nowhere. And he's exasperated afterwards. He says, how come no one else saw this? He checked the people. He checked the news. He just couldn't believe that nobody, he was complete, utter shock. And it changed his life forever. He got obsessed with it. So that movie was really, really, Spielberg understood this about the person, the Close Encounters witness. And they also understood the media, because in the press scene, when Dreyfuss is there and Melinda Dillon, and they're trying to tell a very serious story, and the cameras are on him, the old guy grabs two ashtrays and separates them and says, I once saw a Bigfoot. Separates the ashtrays, and all you watch this shot that is very deliberate that Spielberg has on the news media cameras. They all turn to him, and they completely forget about the two people over here, one whose child was abducted, and the other whose whole life is being turned upside down by his family because of what he experienced. And it was very real, and the audience knows that because they were there. But yet, he wanted to point out to you how the media does what they do, and they're still doing it today. That was in there. And there was just so much to it, the cover up, everything. So that film probably is the best UFO movie ever made, but it wasn't based on an actual case. But actual cases and actual events did influence its development. The best TV movie ever made on the subject was a UFO incident with James Earl Jones and Estelle Parsons about Barney and Betty Hill. That was probably the most amazing TV movie about this subject I'd ever seen, because they didn't change. I read the book and they didn't change anything. And I heard the tapes and they didn't change any of that. It was verbatim, which is a very rare occurrence. And then you move forward and you get to something like Fire in the Sky, and they completely trashed his story, his book, what actually happened. And just made up all this stuff so they could have a spooky Hollywood alien abduction movie. And that was just awful. It was horrible. And they did the same thing with Whitley's book, pretty much. Communion was the people that liked that movie and follow Whitley and follow the subject matter thought that was a great movie. But none of them ever read the book. And if they had read the book, they'd realize what was done there. It was very bad. The movie felt nothing like the book.
With Close Encounters, the depiction of the kid getting picked up by the Greys, these visitors, do you think any of that was really accurate and that's just what it's like?
No, I think that, you know, Spielberg is very much into the subject matter and he knows a great deal about it. He does. I hesitate to talk why I know this, so I will hesitate, because I don't know. He's been so quiet about anything personal with this that I don't want to rock that boat. But he's also a filmmaker. He's also an artist. And he's also an entertainer. So he wanted it to be entertaining as well. So that was very entertaining. I mean, the screws backing out, all the loud sounds and toys moving and things. And sometimes electronic devices are activated. But overall, when these things happen, it's dead silent. Nothing moves. It's like time is standing still. And so if he wanted to have been accurate about how that stuff happened, then he would have had that happen. And maybe cinematically, that wouldn't be as appealing to an audience, because they don't really understand, you know, what it's like when it's real. I know with my film, But Something Is There, I've had many people say to me, there's something wrong with the sound in the first scene. There's no sound there. What's going on with that? I said, there's sound there. You hear him breathing. I said, well, yeah, but you should have had big music and stuff. And I said, no, that's not how it was. It was completely silence. It was eerie how silent and quiet it was. And it literally felt like time was standing still.
Spielberg's got a new UFO film coming out next year.
That's what I hear.
They say it's going to be an event. So who knows what he's going to do with that?
I don't know if he's taking on an actual case and bringing it to life as a film, or if it's another fictional based like Close Encounters. I have no idea. He's been very secretive about it, though. I know that. So, but he always is. I mean, I remember when Close Encounters was being made, I knew a lot about it because a friend of mine was working on it. We got a lot of communication, but I didn't talk about it.
But on the Close Encounters, he had, was it Jacques Vallée and Alan Hynek were advising him?
Yeah, absolutely. And the public didn't realize the significance of that. Only people interested in the subject were, but that's a very small minority. The public was clueless. They just liked the movie. They thought it was wonderful. It gave them a warm and rosy feeling about, you know, the possibility that maybe visitors from another world wouldn't be out to have us for lunch, you know?
So you said that what happened at the end of the movie may have really happened in 1968. Was that called Project Serpo or something else?
Well, it happened out in the desert, but, you know, someone, you know, very well known, very famous and very credible shared that with me. Just the two of us, and told me that it happened. And there wasn't music or anything. There was a big craft that came down and there was an exchange. I believe he said there was an exchange of our people for their people. And that was in Close Encounters, but what I loved about it is that none of them got to go. People thought they did, but they never did. They only took Dreyfus because they wanted the people that are up on that hill, the ones that they sent back on the helicopters, they were the ones that were invited.
But that weird kind of psychological imprint of that Devil's Tower, it's like they put that in their minds somehow, so they'd recognize it.
Right. And they wanted him to go there because they were the ones that were invited. The name of my little short film I did recently was called The Invited.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about your channel. Can you tell us about your YouTube channel and these films that you make for it? Because I really love watching them.
Well, you know, a little over a year ago, Mary came up with the idea of after watching Spielberg's four-part series, Encounters, she said there needs to be something like that, you know, that where people can just go on camera and tell their story and not be led or not be interviewed. And I thought, yeah, well, we could do that, you know, because, you know, we have a studio, I'm a filmmaker, I do visual effects, I made movies and directed and all that. So we just took it on and we got an experiencer to come forward and she went on camera and we shot her on camera and she was very emotional and you could tell what really happened to her. And I put the visuals to it and that show premiered. And it's like within 2 days, it had over 100,000 views. We were in shock. I never interviewed her. I just let her look at the camera and tell her story. So it caught on. So we got more and more people came forward. And eventually we started the live stream show, which we have every Friday at 4 o'clock Pacific Standard Time out here. We've had Whitley on 3 times, but we have also experiencers on. You've been on several times. And that became very popular, not as popular as the films, but then it started also making just films, you know, that were fictional, but based on the subject matter. The most recent one is named The Keep, and that premiered last Saturday, and it went over very well. I was concerned that people might be upset that I was doing fiction and wasn't always doing films based on actual cases, but they weren't. They enjoyed it, and if you watch it through to the end, it's very scary, but if you watch it to the end, it's the ending's quite nice. And so I've gotten a lot of good reviews on that film. It took a lot of work. It's all CGI. I do everything. I don't use AI. I use the tools that I learned while working for Hollywood, working for TV shows and everything else. So they're all computer graphic animations. So, and I, for the most part, a lot of the stuff I make myself, the meshes, the wireframes, I animate them, I bring them to life. I have an enormous backlot, a digital backlot of sets and places and locations and stuff I built up over the year. So now I'm able to do almost anything all inside the computer without ever shooting live action at all. But when I do shoot live action, of course, I can use those techniques to reenact and bring to life what they experienced. And the audience really likes that because just having someone describe something is one thing. But when the description is matched by a visual that really is accurate and very close to what they saw, it brings it to a whole other level. And I didn't realize how well that would work with the public. A lot of people don't like reenactments. Well, they don't like when they get actors to play the people in them because they don't look like them. They don't act like them. It's obviously that they're not A actors. You know, they're just sort of bodies just there, the lights on them. So I didn't know how they'd react to what I was doing, but they love it. So,
yeah, for me, it really brings it to life. Like the experience you have on there when you were a kid in the bedroom, like you were talking about earlier, I really liked that. That really brought it to life while you were talking about it.
Yeah, that was from But Something Was There. And that was done way before we ever started Breaking the Silence. That was started in 2017. We finished the film in 2018. And I did almost all the visuals. We didn't have the software we have now. I was using a software called Lightwave, and I was doing composites and shooting and green screen and all kinds of stuff like that. And we had real actors and real live action. And that was a big undertaking to do that film. Of course, we had Whitley introduce it and talk at the end as well. And I love that little film. I mean, it's really held up well over all these years and people still enjoy it. But it costs a lot of money to do and everything. And so it's not that it doesn't cost money to do what I'm doing now. It does. I mean, the software, the computers necessary to do this kind of work are expensive. And then, of course, a lot of times, I don't know if you saw The Keep yet.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yeah.
Well, that whole island and the keep, that lighthouse is based on The Lighthouse, the movie. It was I don't know if he is Russian or Ukrainian, but there's this gentleman made that whole set and he offered it on Unreal Engine. So you can go into their store and you can, you know, you don't want to spend a ton of time building a lighthouse. You don't have to. So you can just purchase the 3D model and use it. But he had the whole island based on The Lighthouse, which was perfect. It's what I was looking for. I did some modifications to it, but not much because he did a really good job. I purchased that, you know, but it was like $89. It wasn't an enormous amount of money, but it just really helped me because I didn't have to build a lighthouse and the house that goes with it and the interiors and all that stuff. But I did decorate it with chairs and you know, what we call set decking and art direction, all that I did. A lot of things I had to make. The praying mantis beings, those were all made by me. The ship, you know, all the animation, it's a combination of mine and motion capture I used. I've learned how to blend it. It was a lot of work. It took about 2 months to make that. And it was all done stream of consciousness. I knew what I wanted to do. So I sat down at the machine and I went into the house part and I put the character there and I animated the first scene. And I looked at it and watched it and put some little sound to it and stuff. And I went, it works really well. What happens next? And I did that scene. And that the whole film was done that way. It was kind of an experiment. And it worked better than I thought. I think my favorite scene in it is when the ship is lifting off and everything's shaking and you hear that moan coming from the engine and or whatever, the power, and it slips off. And I just love that moment.
It's been great talking to you. I think we've used up enough time and I got a million questions for you I've worked out and I haven't asked any of them. So I think that's a good sign.
Oh, anytime, Simon. Thanks for having me and thank you so much for your wonderful book. I just love it.
Thanks. And that was an interview with Steve Neal about his ET experiences, how real-to-life UFO movies are, and the similarities between the alien abduction experience and near-death experiences. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up to Patreon, where you can get exclusive access to the extended episodes. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFOpodcast. And if you want to try out the extended episodes, you can now get a 7-day free trial. And please check out my new book. It's called Verified Near-Death Experiences, and it's on Amazon. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.